From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Alp Esmer, broadcaster with VOA's Turkish service. Our guest on this edition of the program is Ambassador Francis Ricciardoni, former U.S. ambassador to Turkey, now a vice president at the Atlantic Council, a prominent Washington-based think tank. He is also director of the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. Before joining the council, Ambassador Ricciardoni was a distinguished career diplomat. In addition to Turkey, he served as chargé d'affaires and deputy ambassador to Afghanistan, ambassador to Egypt, and ambassador to the Philippines and Palau. In 1993, he served as political advisor to U.S. and Turkish generals commanding Operation Northern Watch in northern Iraq, based in Turkey. We'll talk with Ambassador Ricciardoni about the domestic, regional, and international implications of Turkey's recent elections, U.S. strategy to contain and ultimately defeat the so-called Islamic State, also known as ISIL, and other related issues. And Ambassador Francis Ricciardoni joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague from VOA's Turkish service, Alp Esmer.
Thank you, Carol.
And I'd like to mention, too, that Alp covered the Turkish elections for us here at the Voice of America. Turning to you, Ambassador Ricciardoni, let's talk about those Turkish election results. Many are hailing them as a victory for democracy, saying that because President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's ruling AKP did not get a majority of seats in the parliament, that the parliament is the most diverse now that it has ever been in decades, that it has curtailed to some extent his ambitions. You know, he wanted to consolidate power in the presidency. I'd like to get your take on the election results. How would you characterize them?
I would characterize them very much along the lines you suggested, Carol, as a very positive outcome for Turkey, for Turkish democracy. In a true sense, everybody won in Turkey. The ruling party itself, after all, did win seats from across the country. It got the plurality of votes. So in that sense, it won, in the sense that it had set an extremely high standard for itself of two-thirds or at least a majority. Of course, it disappointed itself. But the participation rate was phenomenal, something like 85% Alp, very minimum violence, if any, no systematic irregularities, very minor, if any. Civil society rising to the occasion with a spontaneous movement in English called the Vote and Beyond, Oy ve Ötesi. Turks cared about their democracy, turned out in great numbers and gave an exemplary accounting of themselves. So I think this is all to the good. And as you've just pointed out, Carol, the results show a great diversity, not only politically, but greater representation of women in the parliament there than I think we have in the U.S. Congress, greater representation of minorities. I think from all aspects, this is a very happy outcome for Turkish democracy.
On the other hand, it also ushers in a period of greater uncertainty than there ever has been in quite some time. So what do you say to those who are concerned about instability and perhaps the possible inability of forming a coalition government that could lead to fresh elections?
You know, uncertainty is not the same as instability. Democracies face political questions in their various constitutional structures. The constitutional structure of Turkey is certain and stable, I believe, although it is under debate, and the Turks may well decide in the course of a new government to make changes there. But even changes will happen in accordance with the rules. The rule of law, the Turkish state with institutions based on the rule of law, all that's stable. Sure, there's uncertainty. There's crisis in the region. There's conflict in the region. There are important questions at home of national identity, the peace process and where that goes.
Kurdish peace process.
The Kurdish peace process. Economic issues. These are questions that are inherent in any democracy, and if you have a democracy that works according to the rules to debate them, you have a success. That degree of instability or uncertainty is going to be there. It's not the same as instability leading to violence or breakdown of the state.
Let me turn to my colleague Alp for a question.
Thank you, Carol. Mr. Ambassador, I'd like to bring you to the freedoms issue. First of all, this government of AKP, during their previous 12-year period, they started very well with freedoms and democratic reforms. But later on, their course has changed. The government was blamed to be more autocratic. And actually, as an ambassador in Turkey, you were more vocal about press freedoms and personal freedoms, and you were accused of meddling with Turkey's domestic affairs eventually. Are you hopeful about this new political future as far as those freedoms are concerned?
Yes, I am, partly for the reasons I just mentioned. There's a very successful exercise in democracy, greater representation than previously of the opposition parties. In a real sense, I think having a coalition means the opposition and the majority party, or the plurality party, the largest party, the governing party heretofore, are going to have to come to terms within their rules. The role of the media is going to be as vital as ever in all of that. The parliamentary debates, even heretofore, have been very lively and well covered. And from what I can tell, Turks are watching in fascination these very days as they voted just this past week on a new speaker, as the party chiefs negotiate to form coalition. The role of the media is absolutely vital, and the Turks are glued to all their main sources of news and information, including social media.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
Now back to our special guest on Press Conference USA, Ambassador Francis Ricciardoni, former U.S. Ambassador to Turkey, now a vice president at the Washington-based policy group, the Atlantic Council. Well, Ambassador Ricciardoni, you mentioned that there's a lot to deal with, not just internally in Turkey as a result of the elections, but certainly there's conflict and crisis in the region. There's the Kurdish peace process. How do you think these elections, the election results, will affect Turkey's efforts in the region, particularly as it tries to combat ISIL, the so-called Islamic State, in Iraq and Syria with the coalition? But at the same time, we also know that President Erdogan is determined also to combat the most barbaric regime on his border, and that is, of course, President Bashar al-Assad. Mm-hmm. So you have those two enemies right on the border in Syria.
Well, in crisis, there can also be opportunity. The dynamics of a situation can be reshuffled and new openings can happen and new combinations of forces can result. The case of coalition politics that evidently are lying in front of Turkey, perhaps even a second set of elections, who knows, there will be a lot of focus on internal affairs. But that very focus on internal politics will also bring with it public attention to the big issues in foreign policy, which very much include the civil war in Syria, the confrontation with Daesh, the so-called Islamic State, the role of the Kurds and the resonance with the PKK and the Syrian group that's there, and for that matter, the Iraqi Kurds. All of that will get a lot of public examination. That might not lead to rapid decisions, but will probably lead, I think, to well-informed ones the Turkish government will feel confident in pursuing. Turkey's a democracy. Democracies are slow sometimes to come to decisions because public opinion has to be informed and a public consensus has to be developed. That's certainly going to be the case in a period of coalition politics. With respect to the conflicts raging around Turkey, and especially Daesh or ISIS, and the role of the different communities within Syria, including the Kurds, I think this has put into sharper relief than ever the powerful strategic national security interests of Turkey and the United States and our other allies. I believe, by and large, we want the same things. We want a secure Turkish border with Syria. We'd like to see Syria emerge from its civil war intact. We'd like all the various communities, not only the Arabs and the Turkmen, the Christian communities, the Druze, very much the Kurds, to live together in a united Syria. There's no daylight between Turkey and the United States on that from the statements of Turkish leaders, American officials.
However, Mr. Ambassador, I think there is a bit of daylight on one particular issue, and that is the cooperation between the U.S.-led coalition combating ISIL, Daesh, and the Syrian Kurdish YPG. As you know, in recent days, we've read press reports how the Syrian Kurds have become an important U.S. ally in the fight against Daesh. Mm-hmm. However, Ankara is somewhat upset about this development. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan feels threatened by the growing power of the Syrian Kurds and sees them, to some extent, as dangerous, if not more dangerous, than ISIL. What do you say to that?
Well, I think we'd have to ask President Erdogan why he emphasizes the differences, because the Turks, with whom I am still in touch and when I was in office, and the United States government, I am no longer with the United States government, continually worked on the basis of explicit common objectives. Now, I'm not in the U.S. government, but I listen very carefully to what U.S. officials say, and they emphasize the common purposes in defeating Daesh. Turkish officials I knew and still am in touch with from time to time also emphasize the threat that Daesh poses, as well as Al-Qaeda and others, poses to Turkey. So one would have to ask President Erdogan why he's suggesting that the PYD are as big a threat as Daesh. I don't understand that, but that's something for him to explain to his own people. I believe the Kurds have shown in general that they're very strongly opposed and committed to defending themselves and the area where they live from the attacks that Daesh poses on them.
And as you know, Turkey is considering a buffer or security zone within Syrian territory to neutralize the threat against its borders. And also, unless things have changed since I last was in touch with President Erdogan's point of view, what about his suggestion that we need to also combat Assad's barbarity of the dropping of barrel bombs on his own civilian population as much as fighting ISIL? You know, we need to have a two-front war.
Honestly, I think he's absolutely right. We do have to do whatever we can from the outside to help the Syrians defend themselves against the barbaric attacks of Assad. And we should do all we reasonably can to support that.
But would that include, like, creating a buffer zone?
On the question of the buffer zone, the problem I see there isn't enough detailed discussion, certainly not in public. Perhaps there is in official channels now. I'm not in those channels. When you put out the phrase buffer zone, secure zone, no-fly zone, it's easy to see all the problems, the risks, the costs of that. And Secretary Kerry spoke very clearly on this issue the other day, showing the American government is not prepared at this time to support it. My own view is, we really need to understand what the Turks are talking about here. If we're talking about areas in Syria where the Syrian people can establish safe places to live, safe from Daesh, well, that's exactly what the United States is trying to do in working with local groups to protect them. Be safe from other marauding groups or from the Syrian regime. That's also what the United States is trying to do in equipping and being prepared to equip and to train Syrian opposition forces. So I think we need more clarity about what the Turkish government means when it says we should support a no-fly zone or a secure zone. In a certain way, we're doing elements of such a concept now, evidently not satisfactory from the Turkish perspective. But this is the kind of thing that diplomats and allied intelligence officers, allied law enforcement officers, allied humanitarian relief agencies can work on. And indeed, when I was there, at least, we were working together on exactly those problems.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador Francis Ricciardoni, former U.S. ambassador to Turkey, Egypt, and the Philippines, now a vice president at the Washington-based policy group, the Atlantic Council, and director of the Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. I'm your host, Carol Castiel. Joining me on the program is Alp Esmer, a broadcaster in VOA's Turkish service. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Now here's a shout out to a very faithful listener and Facebook fan, Frederica Joe from Monrovia, Liberia. And now a question from Alp.
Mr. Ambassador, my question will be on the domestic issue, but is very much related to the Syrian crisis. During the Kobani clashes, it was the time when the Kurds felt alienated against the AKP government. And apparently President Erdogan and Prime Minister Davutoglu seems to have left this argument about the continuation of the peace process. And so far, whichever coalition will be formed in Turkey, especially the Nationalist Party, is not so eager to continue with the peace process so far with the Kurds. How important is solving the Kurdish issue? And do you see any future in it, in the current political crisis in Turkey?
Alper, I would use a different term for the issue, not looking at it so much as the Kurdish issue, but the democracy issue. And I think that is vitally important for any society to solve, and certainly for Turkey to do so. By that I mean a society that has protections in place, legal protections, so that all citizens feel, no matter what their gender or their ethnicity or their religious beliefs, that they stand equal before the law. That's what I see the struggle to be about within Turkey. Turkey has come a long, long way in securing all those things. When I was there in office, and I've been back to visit as a private citizen, I see Turks continuing that conversation at individual levels and as civil society in the media, in the parliament, in the political parties. And I don't think that's over yet. That peace process may be suspended. It became very strident in recent times. But it isn't over. I think Turks want to advance it and want to come to terms. I believe the Kurdish citizens of Turkey and the rest of the citizens of Turkey need each other. They're intertwined. And I believe the other Kurds of the region, those Kurds in Syria, the Kurds in Iraq, their futures very much depend on having a positive and productive relationship with the Republic of Turkey. It has to happen, whatever comes out of the Syrian civil war.
Mr. Ambassador, I want to take you to a larger question regarding the U.S. strategy to combat ISIL or Daesh. We witnessed recently a string of attacks in Tunisia, Kuwait, France that have been attributed to Daesh. How would you personally evaluate the U.S. strategy so far? It seems to be very heavy on military efforts, but most regional observers say that the counterinsurgency effort, particularly in Iraq, requires much more than just guns. It requires that Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi do more to reach out to Iraq's Sunni community to address corruption in the military, perhaps even jumpstart the formation of a Sunni National Guard. What is your overall assessment of the U.S. strategy?
Well, the president has said we don't have a complete strategy. I think he was speaking fact. It is a complex situation. The perspective I take, and we at the Atlantic Council are working on, is that what we're observing is a crisis of the regional order based on the legitimacy or the failure of legitimacy of states, basically in the post-Ottoman region. When World War I, the Great War, happened, it turned the world upside down for so many different peoples who live in that region. There was an order of governance that people understood, whether the governance was good or bad or corrupt or benevolent. Everyone understood the order of the world, in the Ottoman world at least. When that was gone and another order was more imposed from the outside than generated from within, that order more or less functioned through the rest of the 20th century and then failed in a number of spots, Syria, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, where we are now. Palestine is still struggling to be established as a legitimate state, legitimate in the eyes of its own people, legitimate in the eyes of the world. So that's the big problem. At the Atlantic Council, we have a project co-chaired by a Republican, Steve Hadley, very eminent one, former National Security Advisor under President Bush, and a Democrat, Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, to overcome the partisan issues in our politics as we look at this problem. We're breaking out the problem into several different aspects. So certainly the security piece that you referred to, Carol, is one. Yes, there is an important military and law enforcement and intelligence security component. That's vitally important. We're going to have to collaborate to defeat Daesh that way. But the problem isn't only defeating Daesh. There's a massive humanitarian catastrophe. We cannot turn our backs on the millions of people who are displaced from their homes, millions of them across national borders. Turkey is showing exemplary generosity and compassion in hosting 2 million. But the Jordanians, the Lebanese, the Iraqis are also hosting Syrians who are displaced from their country. The second aspect is humanitarian. A third aspect is the role of religion in regenerating legitimate states and encountering fanaticism, violent extremism. So that's a third chapter we have. A fourth aspect is governance. Doesn't necessarily have to be democracy. There are states that govern wisely, states that exist to serve their people and protect their people and enable them to have economic activity and live in dignity. So governance is a fourth aspect that people in the region and we outside who have a stake in the region have to work on together. Finally, economic regeneration and activity. How to move from subsistence and even criminal activity into legitimate pro-growth activity that will provide jobs for a generation of people. Those five areas are the components that we need to address within a strategy, and I'm very pleased that the Atlantic Council is leading a bipartisan effort to deal with that, not only in the United States, but with friends in the region, in Turkey, in the Arab world, and in Europe.
Well, indeed, and I guess the question is the administration listening?
Indeed. We have the administration is involved in this conversation. We're in touch with administration officials, and as much to the point, we hope the future administration is listening. We're in touch with advisors to the declared and expected presidential candidates. So we hope that this Atlantic Council project will inform the presidential debates into next year.
And one quick follow-up, Mr. Ambassador, to this point that many analysts are making that politically more needs to be done. There is this now a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia in the region, the Shia-dominated Iraqi government vis-a-vis its Sunni community. And, you know, you have, obviously, Iran backing the Shia-led government in Iraq, which isn't to say that the new prime minister, Haider al-Abadi, isn't doing his best to reach out to the Sunni. But what about these underlying political problems that many say need to be addressed if, in fact, the humanitarian catastrophe is ultimately addressed? It's one thing to address the humanitarian fallout, but we need to do that by addressing these political problems. Do you think enough pressure is being applied, whether in Iraq, vis-a-vis reaching out to address Sunni grievances, which are at the root of, to some extent, the growth of Daesh?
Carol, I don't know if it's a matter of pressure. In some cases, it's extreme pressure. It's outright violence, illicit violence, of course, and then one would argue licit on the part of the Iraqi state to try to resolve that within Iraq. The problem of sectarianism, truly devilish one. There may be limits on what we on the outside can do. I believe it does need to be resolved from within the world of Islam. But I hope that we on the outside can also contribute by providing safe spaces for conflict resolution efforts. That's more easily done, again, where there is a regional order based on legitimate, well-governed states, which is the focus of the Atlantic Council project I just mentioned. I think in that context, people tend to look to the United States and trust the United States. We may be able to encourage and play a role. Certainly the United States is a safe space for Shiites and Sunnis to live together and show that that can be done. And not only Shiites and Sunnis, but Christians and Muslims and atheists and Jews and Buddhists and everyone else. So I hope the outcome of this conflict is going to be a situation where states can work together. You mentioned Iran. If there's a deal between Iran and the P5 plus one, where Iran becomes more normally a member of the community of nations, perhaps they can help work on this problem instead of contributing to the problem.
Of course, detractors or pessimists would say if a deal is struck and sanctions are lifted, that Iran would come into a lot of financial support that they could then steer toward their nefarious activities in the region, supporting the Assad regime, continuing to back the Houthi rebels in Yemen, and again, you know, fueling this sectarian divide between Saudi Arabia and its Sunni Gulf allies and Iran.
That's true. If they stay on a hegemonistic course, devote additional resources to that, it would be dreadful and it will only make things worse. I believe the machinery is in place, though, to keep up the pressures, as you say, and there would be diplomatic pressures to try to contain, channel, prevent, mitigate hegemonistic behavior on the part of Iran or any single player in the region.
I was just wondering, is it only Iran contributing to the sectarian strife? And I mean, are there other countries actually trying to put more fuel into the sectarian conflict in the region?
Well, clearly there's a non-state actor doing exactly that, and it's one that dares and presumes to call itself a state. That's its ambition, ISIS or Daesh. Beyond that, I believe that there are sectors of states or elements within states that teach sectarianism and teach otherization, that teach hate. And some dare to do this in the name of religion. I don't consider that very enlightened to the extent there are religious groups that do that. That stands against the world's rules-based order, which promotes human rights. If everyone would take another look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and live to that and teach to that, perhaps we could mitigate some of this horrible sectarianism that states and non-state actors are promoting.
Do you have any state in mind when you say that, Mr. Ambassador?
I would say any state that has public instruction that is unexamined for this, that doesn't emphasize the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that teaches otherization, that stresses the superiority of this sect over another, would fit that category. And I'm not expert enough to know what different ones are doing, but we can all guess from a lot of the political discourse in certain states that which ones are more culpable.
Well, as we close, Mr. Ambassador, I want to go back to Turkey. Turkey's desire to eventually accede to the European Union. I'd like to know where these talks stand, and particularly in light of what's going on with Greece, the default. Some members of the European Union may be wondering why they didn't accelerate the talks with Turkey, which, notwithstanding its economic difficulties at this moment, still is in a much better place than Greece.
There are a lot of bad feelings on both sides of Turkish politics. Have taken a nationalistic turn, and there have just been terrible disappointments on both sides, the European Union side and the Turkish side, over these past several years. There have been several straws in the wind, even before the most recent elections in Turkey, showing that it remains at least the official policy of the Turkish government to continue to work toward accession with great sobriety about when that might happen and under what terms and conditions. One of the drivers of this is the United States negotiations with the European Union for transatlantic trade and investment partnership that is of great concern to Turkey and is putting pressure, in fact, on Turkey. And I think that will help sustain, if that comes to pass between the United States and the EU, that should help.
Be an incentive for Turkey?
I would hope so. Be an incentive for Turkey to fully accede to the European Union. But there's a lot that Turkey has to do.
Exactly. And quickly before I close, Alp, what is your sense of the Turkish electorate? Where do they stand vis-a-vis accession to the EU? Is there a popular sentiment in favor still?
They're very much disappointed. I mean, maybe recent public opinion polls are showing there's a little bit increase towards the European Union membership, but truly you can see that disappointment among the Turkish electorate about how promises were turned away and how they feel very much frustrated about Europe's turning its back towards Turkey. But, Mr. Ambassador, you served in Turkey 3 times over a 20-year period. Can you really tell Turkey has more westernized or going backwards?
I think Turkey has come a long way forward. I don't see any moving backward on the part of Turkey. The pace of change accelerates or slows down from time to time, but the direction for me has remained constant. It's toward greater education, greater prosperity, much stronger institutions of democracy. These elections that we've just discussed at the outset, I think, are a great example. That there's civil society strong enough to organize poll watching wasn't there in the past. Turkish participation in this race, this is not coercion. No one pays a fine if you don't show to vote. This is Turkish hearts dedicated to democracy and being excited about it. So I'm very optimistic about Turkey's direction. There'll be a lot of noise. There's great seriousness in parliamentary debate. When I was there in my most recent tour, there are fundamental, very well-informed public debate about the Constitution, about the very identity of what it means to be a Turkish citizen and how to protect the rights of the citizen versus the state, not how to strengthen the state against the citizen. It was more about the duties of the state to the citizen. So this is very mature discourse. Now, there's a lot of immature anger and emotion and screaming. That's always been there. Hopefully that will improve too.
Ambassador Francis Ricciardoni is a vice president at the Atlantic Council. He's also director of the Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your wonderful insights.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Carol, for having me. Thank you, Alpe.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Linus Rimkus. And joining me on the program was VOA Turkish service broadcaster Alp Esmer. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.